Hello, my name is Ryan Hamill, and I am the host of New Humanists, the podcast of the Ancient Language Institute. As always, I'm here with Jonathan Roberts, my co-host and co-founder of the Ancient Language Institute. We are on a quest to discover what a renewed humanism looks like for the modern world. Jonathan, I'm excited to chat with you about episode number 2.
The Year of Our Lord, 1943, by Alan Jacobs, is our book for today. So Ryan, how about you first tell us, why did you pick this book?
Sure. Yeah. Why did I pick this book? I read this book a year or two ago. It was a great read. It's got a pretty awesome cover. This kind of old-fashioned serif-y font on front of a picture of Coventry Cathedral. Coventry has just been bombed in the Blitz. That's the picture. There's all this kind of rubble in the foreground. And then in the background, just a silhouette is the spire of the cathedral rising above everything. And for World War II buffs, we'll know that Coventry was one of the city's worst hit in the Blitz. Knowing something about the publishing industry, I kind of doubt that Alan Jacobs had much input on the cover, but I wouldn't be surprised just given how perfect this is. Rubble with the church, kind of hazy, but still standing. How poetically apt it is. Anyway, so awesome cover. I like Alan Jacobs. He wrote my favorite biography of C.S. Lewis, The Narnian. So yeah, I kind of picked it up, didn't really know what to expect, absolutely loved it. And then, yeah, I chose it for our podcast because our podcast is all about discovering a renewed humanism. And lo and behold, look at the subtitle of the book, Christian Humanism in an Age of Crisis. I said, what a great start. I mean, we had episode 1 that was just kind of introducing ALI, introducing new humanists, but what a great start to our podcast proper is this book.
Right. Yeah. Great cover, great font, great cast of characters. So he's looking at, am I going to mispronounce this? Maritain.
Whatever. We're in America. It's a French name. Who cares?
Maritain, T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, W.H. Auden, and Simone Weil. Hard to go wrong with that cast of characters.
No kidding. Yeah, so the conceit of the book is really interesting. The Year of Our Lord, 1943. It's all about this one year. And of course, he ventures well in advance of that year and well after that year too. But the central concern is that one year. It was the year that the tide was beginning to turn in World War II. It kind of became clear that Hitler was going to lose in 1943. It was the year of the Casablanca Conference. And it was also the year, I don't know how he ended up piecing this all together, but these five people that Jonathan just named, all that year happened to be writing about the same thing: Western civilization, Christianity, education, and humanism.
Right. Yeah. They're all thinking, looking at the future and thinking about the state of the world after the war. It's like, given that the war is going to be won, at least in a military sense, how then shall we live, in the words of Francis Schaeffer? What comes next? One of their concerns is that while the Axis faction, you know, will lose the war in a military sense, all of these writers have this preoccupation that they might actually win ideologically. That we kind of already identifying myself with a side here, but that the Allies.
Well, I hope you would not identify yourself with the Axis.
Yes, I do not. I do not. But, you know, I don't want to claim credit for the victory over the Axis. I just wasn't there, despite how old I sound. So, part of the concern is, how do we avoid becoming this sort of civilization that is possessed by totalitarian ideology?
Yeah.
And I think all of the authors, in one sense or another, kind of see that the Allies and their respective countries kind of already have the seeds of totalitarian, power-hungry, ideologically possessed ways of operating.
Yeah.
Simone Weil probably sees this in the most personal sort of way. Her discussion of that is really interesting, and we'll get more into that. But I just really remember that passage where she's talking about why she wants to avoid associations with institutions or, you know, with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And she says, I have no doubt that if I was in a room with 20 German Nazis and they were all singing, you know, their spirited patriotic songs, I myself would become part Nazi. Well, part of my soul would become Nazi is what she says.
Lewis says the same thing. Is that in this book? I can't remember or not. Lewis has a quote that's almost identical to the paraphrase you gave of A, where he listens to one of Hitler's speeches on the radio. And he's like, wow, if you let yourself, you can believe.
Right.
You can believe. And I mean, these people, Vey is basically a pacifist. Like, this is not a kind of borderline Nazi character. She's like this mystical Jewish Christian woman.
Right.
Who's a pacifist.
Yep.
Lewis fought in the trenches against Germany in World War I.
Yeah. Not a pacifist.
Not a pacifist, but, you know, had skin in the game in the struggle for England. And volunteered as an air raid warden in World War II, took kids in the countryside, fleeing the Blitz in his home. Also, skin in the game. These are not kind of crypto Nazis. And yet they understood on a deep kind of empathic level the appeal of totalitarianism. So it's not just them tagging the elites of their culture as, oh, you guys are so corrupt, you're prey to totalitarian temptations. They said, I can see it myself.
Right.
Why someone might want this kind of thing.
Right. And so that's a central preoccupation in their writings. And we see this theme of how do we cultivate people that are not, you know, are not ideologically possessed and are not rushing towards totalitarianism in various forms, not simply in an ideological way. For instance, this is a concern of T.S. Eliot. It's like, how do we avoid a certain kind of nationalism? Probably different from the very muddled conversations on nationalism today. Seems like when Eliot is talking about nationalism, he really does mean some sort of totalitarianism and some sort of disordered patriotism. And there's also this other concern, not simply with regards to like this disordered sense of national identity, but also a move towards technocracy.
Yes.
Trying to manage and rule everything through the power of technology.
Yes, that is absolutely central, at least to my reading of this book. I remember the first time I read this book, it was when I was on a like Inklings and Lewis binge. And so I read like 4 Lewis biographies and like 2 books on the Inklings. And then I read this. This is kind of Inklings adjacent. And I said to my friend after reading it, kind of, he's like, what do you think? I'm like, oh, I liked it, but I didn't like the ending. They all like, they lost and died. He's like, well, yeah, I mean, everyone dies. What kind of ridiculous criticism? But I had that in mind as I came back and read it again. And what I think I was picking up on is the essentially tragic nature of the book. Not just the tragic nature of the story, that's one thing, which is true, but the way Jacobs frames it all. And so he says at the beginning, in the preface, he says, my narrative method is similar to the long tracking shot in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. And so I've never seen that movie. So I went and looked up a YouTube video and watched it a few times. And it follows this couple as they're walking down the street. I have no idea where they are. And it's this kind of bustling street scene. And then the camera leaves them and follows someone else. And so it's all these people on their kind of intersecting errands, doing various things. It's kind of following all of them as they come in and out of the frame. And it all culminates with a huge explosion, a car that explodes in the distance. It's a car bomb. And he says, this is what my book is. It's following these 5 characters who are all writing about the same thing at the same time with similar goals. But it all ends with an explosion. He says, I will leave as an exercise for the reader what the explosion corresponds to. But I think that's the whole point, is it's a tragic story and it's a tragic book because they totally lose. The epilogue to this book leaves the 5, a quintet, and goes to a new thinker, Jacques Ellul, another Frenchman that brings it. I didn't think about this. three Anglos and three French people.
Got to even it out somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Feel bad for the French. Got to give them an extra one. But Elul has this crazy quote here in the afterword, which I think helps explain this bomb. He calls the end of World War II this horrifying triumph of the Hitlerian spirit that we now see throughout the world. So the central question you're posing at the beginning, how do we achieve not only military victory, but also philosophic victory or spiritual victory? We make sure that totalitarianism doesn't win the peace, so to speak. And I think Jacob's perspective, clearly Elul's perspective, is that did not happen. We won the military victory and lost the spiritual victory. Hitler won, which is a shocking thing to say.
Yeah.
But I think that's what makes it so tragic. You had this sudden flowering of humanistic energy at the end of the war, 1943, and then just the absolute crushing of it when the reign of technocracy and transhumanism, I think, really took over, which I think we can jump from there to the first main topic we want to talk about relative to this book, which is humanism. Surprise, surprise, the new humanists want to talk about humanism. And so Jacobs has a unique definition of the word because he acknowledges that, yeah, the first thing it means is this movement of Renaissance humanism in Italy, first in Italy and then in Northern Europe. And he says, Maritain is the only one of our dramatis personae for whom the concept of humanism is straightforwardly compelling. As a literary scholar, Lewis would have been like, humanism, I'm not a humanist. I'm, you know, I'm living in 20th century England. I'm not in 14th century Italy. I'm not a humanist. Eliot kind of played with the term. Maritain adopted it. Simone Weil was an antagonist to Maritain in a lot of ways, so she did not like the term. But Jacobs nevertheless persists in using the term. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. He has a great quote from Milton. He says, here's why I use the term for what they're all doing. All of them believe that they're living in the age of the crisis of man, and that that crisis can only be resolved by the restoration of the specifically Christian understanding of the human being as such. All of them would have endorsed, generally speaking, though perhaps not without slight amendment, John Milton's great statement, that the end of learning is to repair the ruins of our first parents. But they also share the conviction that this restoration will not be accomplished only or even primarily through theology as such. And this is what really ties it in to Renaissance humanism, but also makes it relevant for us. This restoration is not just through theology, but also and more effectively through philosophy, literature, and the arts. It is through these practices, which I believe are best called humanistic, that the renewal, or if necessary, the revolutionary upheaval of Western civilization will be achieved. That was the project that these figures, in the various ways and with their sometimes fierce disagreements, shared. So, Jonathan, where does this word come from? What is humanism?
So we have this phrase. We see it in one of the key figures that was a kind of model and inspiration of the Renaissance movement. Cicero, in his oration for Archias the poet, has this phrase, studium humanitatis ac literarum, which Ryan pointed out to me that in this very fine book published by Oxford University Press.
Not to name names.
Yeah, not to throw anyone under the bus. There's a typo, right? Page 37, we can even tell you the page. Page 37, if you buy the book and check it out, just be sure to go to page 37 and change the phrase from studium humanitatis ac literatum to studium humanitatis ac literarum. The study of human things and letters. That's essentially the elevator version of it. It's like the study of human things and of letters. Okay. Well, what is that and why is that? And so that is really the question. And answering that question will give you a sense as to like what motivated the early moderns or the Renaissance figures, the Renaissance humanist figures, in terms of their own studies. What were they trying to accomplish? And there's definitely this moral element.
Yeah.
This kind of desire for a moral reformation and moral fortification by means of the study of history, literature, philosophy, and rhetoric, especially.
In contrast to kind of high and late medieval scholarship, which was heavily theological.
Right, yeah. And instead of wanting to discuss, like, the nature of angels, you know, and really intense metaphysical questions, they had the moral concerns that we have just brought up, but also the desire to look at the texts themselves, right? It's not, they didn't want to simply read another commentary on a translation of scripture into Latin, right? Like, how about we read the Greek? How about we look at the sources themselves? How about we look at the Greek New Testament? How about we look at Cicero? What was Cicero saying? What was he up to? So there's these two motivating impulses and concerns. And in terms of their moral project, they believed that we human beings could benefit from literature and from history because these two sources provide us with countless of figures or examples that inspire our, we might even use that overused phrase, or moral imaginations, how we morally conceive of the universe and our place in it, and what sorts of things are possible for human beings to achieve, to accomplish. And this is both, of course, there's a positive and negative sense to this, because human beings are capable of doing really great things, but also we shouldn't be naive, right?
Right.
Human beings are also capable of doing things that are not so great. And history can help us see that.
Yeah. One thing I want to hit on that we mentioned last episode is, okay, so when we say humanism, we don't just mean Petrarch and the Italian humanists or the Northern humanists like Erasmus, but neither do we mean secular humanists, which is quoted Francis Schaeffer. So fans of Francis Schaeffer might be a little wary of adopting the language of humanism because it could be interpreted to mean that man is the measure of all things, that there's no transcendent dimension, that humanity is kind of worthy of adoration, if anything is, or that we should, even if there is a transcendent, is irrelevant for, you know, morality, politics, etc., etc. That's not what we mean. In fact, with this oration of Cicero that we talked about, there's actually some really interesting parallels between what Cicero says, and this is just kind of to push back against the secular humanist thing, between that and the Apostle Paul. For one, Cicero is defending in this oration his friend Aulus Licinius, whose citizenship is on trial in Rome. And because his friend is a poet, Cicero kind of puts poetry on trial. He says, if we can defend poetry, then we can determine that he's a good Roman citizen. And so Cicero has to kind of make a defense of the liberal arts, of the humane things and humane letters before the jury. And so he asks his listeners, how many images of the bravest of men, not merely for contemplating, but also for imitating, have the Greek and Latin writers left to us? And it's a rhetorical question. The implied answer is a very high number.
Right.
And so what's so great about that? Well, Cicero's a very respected statesman in Rome. And so he says, well, had I not been persuaded in my youth by many lessons and many books that nothing in life is to be desired more than glory and integrity, and that in their pursuit, the excruciating torture of the body, the danger of death and the danger of exile are all to be taken lightly, then I would never have for your sake subjected myself to such terrible strife and to the daily attacks of desperate men. So Cicero is saying, what's apparent to your senses is not the last word on what is real. The excruciating torture of the body feels very real, but it should be taken lightly if by enduring it you can obtain glory and integrity. To me, I read this and just hear Romans 8, when Paul says, for I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. So in neither case, Cicero or Paul, are they saying that suffering is an illusion or that it doesn't matter? They're just saying that it should be taken lightly in comparison to reality in all its fullness, the glory which shall be revealed in Paul's case. And so I think there's a similar project going on here between some of what Paul talks about and the humanist project. Another Pauline quote I think of is Philippians 4:8. And Paul says, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, and if there be any praise, think on these things." Paul does not say, whatever falls within the faculty of theology, whatever belongs to scripture study, think on these things. He says, anything that's true and honest and just and pure and lovely, there be any virtue, think on these things. And that is the capacious view of reality that the humanists have, that we're not here to modernize the world or to kick God out of the academy or any of that. They were there to see the divine touch in everything, which is very different from how the Humanist Project is often portrayed. I think it's worth keeping these things in mind.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is this parallel between what Cicero is saying. I think it's a section a little bit earlier from where you read, where he says, "But I confess that I am devoted to those studies. Let others be ashamed of them if they have buried themselves in books without being able to produce anything out of them for the common advantage or anything which may bear the eyes of men and the light." In other words, if you're just going to do this, you know, if you're just going to be reading books so that you can be the biggest nerd on earth, you should be ashamed of yourself. Right?
If you're just a nerd.
Yeah, if you are just doing this, just because you want to be the person that can, you know, quote whichever author you like the most better than anyone else, right? If you're just doing it so that you can write the most obscure PhD dissertation possible, you should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Cicero's perspective, right? That you should study and contemplate these models so that you might benefit other people and more broadly your city, right? There's this political civilizational concern.
Yeah.
Something that the Renaissance humanists definitely had in mind, right? They all kind of aspired to be advisors of princes.
Yep.
You want to be in a position where you've acquired wisdom and you can bestow it upon those who are making decisions concerning public life.
Right.
And this ties precisely into the concerns of our authors, or not our authors, but Alan Jacobs' figures that he's focusing on. They all have this concern for public life, for the state of their, you know, respective civilizations. They have this desire for their cities to do well. And in this sense, we could say that they're all humanists.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They're not simply interested in being learned and then just, you know, hiding their candles under their beds.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking, what can we do to benefit, you know, to benefit others? And this is why they turn their attention towards, you know, the topics that Jacobs focuses on in this book. So humanism is a very apt subtitle to this book.
Yeah, and it's really inspired that when these Italian scholars turn to Cicero and turn to the Greek and Latin authors to go back to the sources, that they ended up being called this. Because as Jacobs talks about, humanista was Italian college slang, because you had the scholars of the law who are called juristas. And so then these scholars got into these human things. So they were called humanistas. And that's where we get the term humanist. It's really inspired choice of word. It shows up multiple times in Proarchia. I'll just share this one more Cicero quote, and then we can kind of move on. He says, "Indeed, all the arts which pertain to humanity have some common link and are held together as if by some familial relation." And part of that familial relation, at least part of it, is what you were talking about, Jonathan, where it's this broader concern, not just with knowing all the citations, but concern for the city and concern for the soul. that you can benefit. You can benefit your fellow man. That's why it's humanist. And by contrast, this is my contrast I really want to draw. Jacobs doesn't do it explicitly. He's with transhumanism, which I think is ascendant right now among a lot of people, technologists and leaders, where we can use technology. That's the word Jacobs really uses, is technology and technique, borrowing from Elul. But I want to put that all under this umbrella of transhumanism, this idea that we can use that stuff in order to surmount human nature and conquer it and run society completely objectively with machines and algorithms and bots. And that's what I think the real bomb is, the real explosion is, from the preface, from this tracking shot, Touch of Evil, because he wants it to be an exercise for the reader. So it's...
We're exercising.
I consider myself exercised. I thought about it a lot. On the one hand, the bomb is clearly the bomb. It's the atom bomb. That's how the war ended, is America invented this technological terror and then dropped it on civilian populations and killed tens of thousands of people in a matter of seconds. That's how the war ended. But it's bigger than that, too. It's the whole complex of thought that gave rise to not just the ability to build that bomb, but the mindset that we ought to do it. That
right.
Dropping the bomb on civilian populations is a good idea. And so I want to read this quote. I think it illustrates this really well. It's in a discussion of W.H. Auden's poem. God, what is it called? Totally love this poem. Under Which Liar, a reactionary tract for the times, which all of our listeners should absolutely go read. Stop listening to our podcast. At least put it on pause. Go read this poem. It's absolutely hilarious, but it's really worth thinking about. Jacobs discusses the poem, and then he discusses the situation in which it was recited, which was at Harvard in shortly after the war ended, 46, I think. Jacob says, it is telling that Auden read this poem at Harvard. One of the dominant figures of American culture at that time was James Bryant Conant, a former professor of chemistry who had become Harvard's president in 1933. He participated enthusiastically in the techno-utopian mood of the mid-1940s and played a significant role in Washington. He was a member of the Secret Interim Committee that had advised President Truman, get this, to drop atomic bombs on Japanese cities, and Auden suspected that Conant's vote to bomb had been decisive.
Yeah, wow.
Later on, Jacob says, Auden was polite to Conant, but, and he quotes, this is the real enemy, I thought to myself. And I'm sure he had the same impression about me.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's the, what, you know, the humanist aspired to be wise. To know what would be good and in accordance to nature and in accordance to humanity,
yep.
Living in harmony, right? At least that's the ideal, obviously, you know. It's hard to live up to ideals, but it's good to have the right ideals.
Right. You have absolutely no chance of living up to good ideals if you have bad ones.
Right. And so instead of having, you know, men who have dedicated themselves to learning, to the study of human nature, to the study of human affairs, of public affairs.
Yeah.
We have basically a technocrat, somebody who has a very narrow view of the world, giving advice to the president of the United States of America on whether or not to drop a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think you were talking about the Renaissance humanists and how they aspired to advise princes. And they wrote all these mirrors for princes. It's like, here's how to educate a prince. Here's how you should rule. Here's all the stuff you should do. Going back to classical antiquity, similar things were going on. Aristotle tutoring Alexander the Great. Plato going to, what, Syracuse to try and, I don't know the full story on Plato and Syracuse, but they were doing similar things. And here you have the president of Harvard, the most esteemed college in America, casting a vote on a committee established by the president. I mean, he's doing the thing. This is what the humanists wanted to do. And so this is something we'll come back to at the end in a different section of the podcast about just the total abject failure of these humanists, Maritain, Vey, Lewis, Eliot, and Auden. They just totally failed. Power in the West did not take them seriously. They didn't accomplish what they want. Instead, you got what Elul called the triumph of the Hitlerian spirit. It's pretty bleak.
Yeah.
It's pretty bleak. So by contrast, this is an interesting thing Jacobs kind of brings in really briefly with a T.S. Eliot quote, where he's contrasting the transhumanist mode, which has as its kind of unifying characteristic technology. Technology is the thing that connects all of us and makes us all part of one coherent civilization. And then on the other hand, you have a humanist civilization that is now gone. And what was the technology, quote unquote, humanist civilization? The one thing that united everybody, that made everybody feel like they're part of one civilization. Jacobs writes, Eliot knows that the development of post-war society will not work to sustain and nourish the local things he loves. The unifying and universalizing power of Latin is gone, and it is being replaced by the very different universalizing power of science and technocracy. So there's my pitch for signing up for a Latin class with the Ancient Language Institute. This is the unifying and universalizing power of a humanistic civilization that has kind of disappeared just because we're lazy and dumb, but it doesn't have to be that way. You can learn Latin. It's not as hard as people say. It'll take work. It's not impossible.
T.S. Eliot says, sign up.
Yes, we're endorsed.
What more can we say?
Yeah.
Just really quickly to kind of highlight something that we touched upon at the beginning is they have this concern, right, that while military victory might be achieved, ideological victory might not be achieved. And this is a snapshot of that. And it's like this Harvard College president acting in a way that these authors would have considered to be in the spirit how the Axis faction was operating in.
Right.
It's just victory at all costs, sort of. That sort of mentality is one of their fears, that you might become the very thing that you're seeking to destroy. The words of some sage.
Living on Tatooine.
Right.
So the real subject of the book, I mean, humanism is in the subtitle, but the real subject, I think, is education. And so it's humanistic education. But all these subjects, these five, this quintet, they're all thinking about education. That's the thing that we absolutely have to get figured out if we're going to kind of salvage civilization from this kind of grinning, soft Hitlerian spirit. So what are some of the key takeaways? Because we're not just trying to do a book summary. We're trying to not be
the nerds.
Yeah, not be the Ciceronian nerd. We're not just trying to recite page numbers to you. We're trying to actually benefit ourselves and the people around us. So our listeners, what are like the key points on education Jacobs wants us to walk away with?
Yeah, one of the so many works that he cites, I mean, this book is kind of like a shot of whiskey every other page, because there's so much in here. When I think of like the one of the main takeaways from this book, it's hard for me not to think about C.S. Lewis's piece, Learning in Times of War.
Yeah.
Because it's almost the perfect encapsulation of everything that he's talking about. Between learning in times of war and the abolition of man, you can kind of get a snapshot of the concerns of all of these authors, broadly speaking, because some of them are quite different. Like, especially Simone Weil is really different. But one of the things that I was thinking about after reading this is Lewis in this piece kind of talks about the significance of learning and education, because war is a temporary reality and the business of life, public and private, is perennial. It's ongoing.
Yeah.
And you can't afford to neglect these studies. If they are as valuable as, for instance, the humanists believe that they are, or these authors believe they are, you can't afford to neglect them because you're in war.
Just as a quick side note, I saw this essay, Learning in Wartime, pop up multiple times over the past year and a half during coronavirus, just because there's a similar sentiment. We're kind of surrounded by crisis and panic and death and all this stuff. So what good is this kind of long-term, long-range planning?
Right.
The kind of mass mobilization that coronavirus entailed. I mean, just what event other than a war could affect every single person in such an intimate way at the same time?
Right.
All at the same time. And so a lot of people were citing this because it's like, look, there's this huge interruption to normal processes of life. And yet life felt like it stopped during lockdown. Life didn't actually stop. And so you have to keep going on with this stuff.
Yeah. And the stuff that you continue to do, it's the stuff that you care about.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's a sad time seeing what people decided to sacrifice and just totally neglect. One of the things that I kept thinking about as reading this book is that quote, that classic quote, "Si vis pacem, para bellum." If you want peace, prepare for war. And thinking of that quote in the context of Lewis's work here, even if you have peace, you can't take it for granted.
Right.
You can't just expect, you know, that things are going to be fine, that things are going to be good, that you're not going to have to fight. It seems like he could almost have written a piece called Learning at Every Time.
Right.
Because war and human conflict and the reality of human sin and frailty.
The reality of death. I mean, that's what it is, right? That's the common thread between war and coronavirus and all these things, is death is coming for you.
Right.
Yeah.
So what do you do, right? What do you do? Netflix or something else?
Yep.
Right?
I confess I did watch the entire Star Wars Clone Wars series during lockdown. It's like 9 seasons. So I know that of which we're speaking, human frailty, binging Star Wars cartoons.
There you go. So that's one of the takeaways for me, is thinking about just the reality of civilizational frailty as being a pretty much a permanent fixture.
Yeah. So this conversation has been awesome, but it's gone a little bit longer than I expected. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut off here for now. And then next time in 2 weeks, when we meet again, we'll continue the conversation about Jacob's book, because we've got a lot more to say. It's a great book. I hope you've enjoyed it so far. So for today, I'm Ryan Hamill with Jonathan Roberts. This is New Humanist. Thanks so much for listening. Please visit our site, ancientlanguage.com. Go to wherever you listen to your podcasts, give us a thumbs up, 5 stars, write a little review so that people can find us, so that the algorithm knows that we have listeners. We've gotten some great feedback already. Thank you so much.